Okay, today we have a very interesting seminar on supersonic flow by our very own Shizu Sabnis. Can we please give him a warm welcome?
Thank you. So I'm going to be talking today about a study that we've been doing experiments and it's been in collaboration with computations. And during this, we've actually discovered quite a lot about our wind tunnel. So you all know Holger Babinski, my supervisor. So we've been doing the experiments here and at the US Air Force Research Lab, Dan Galbraith and Jack Bennett have been doing some computations. And I should also say thanks to the technicians, Dave and Tony, because without them, none of these experimental results would have been possible. So the study we're talking about is based on corner flows within supersonic flows. And we see these kinds of corner geometries in a lot of industrial applications, whether it's the inlet of fighter aircraft, whether it's the wing body junctions on transonic aircraft or internal machinery. We can see these corner boundary layers developing. And in all of these cases, within a supersonic flow, there's some sort of shock. Now, when these corner boundary layers see this shock, they tend to separate. And this separation can be seen to have quite a large impact on the actual applications. But despite this kind of big impact of the corner regions, in fact, they're not really well understood. So the separation in the corner isn't reliably predicted by RANS methods, which need to be used in industry due to their lower computational costs and more higher fidelity methods. But more fundamentally, just not even the separation, but the actual structure of the flow in the corners can't be reliably predicted by these methods. And so our study is really to look at how well do these RANS methods compute the structure and the flow in these supersonic corners. So people generally talk about joint experimental and computational studies, but as a kind of one big family. But in fact, it might be useful to kind of split these up a bit more. So I've kind of separated them into three main types of study, and you'll see they have increasing complexity. So at the most fundamental level, what I've called a phenomenological study basically involves having a complex bit of flow physics and then using experiments to work out one aspect of it, computation to work out another aspect, and then when we put them together, we can learn something more about the flow. A bit more involved than that is what I've called verification. So say we've got some sort of computation that tells us something about the flow physics, we want to see how well does it actually capture the flow. So we do a series of experiments and see whether these experiments match the computational results. And then the third case, what I've said is validation. In fact, test the capability of the numerical model itself by using high quality data and comparing that with the computations. So in our case, we're looking at a validation study, and this has the highest requirements in terms of accuracy of experimental data and in terms of trying to make sure that the computations actually capture the wind tunnel flow. So how do we study these supersonic corner flows in a supersonic wind tunnel? Well, you can see here the schematic of our wind tunnel with the converging, diverging nozzle and the test section. But we actually look at the corners of the wind tunnel flow itself where a boundary layer is developed and use these as the target of a validation study. So throughout this validation study, when designing and conducting experiments, we've taken some conventional or long-held views. For example, the fact that as experimentalists, we should be aiming to build a perfect wind tunnel, or the fact that in order to reduce computational cost, it's only necessary to model the region we're directly interested in, or the fact that experimentalists and CFD people hate each other so they don't need to communicate, and we've kind of turned them on their heads. So it's now becoming more and more accepted that it's difficult or even impossible to build and operate an absolutely perfect wind tunnel. And as CFD has got better and better, it can start to capture those imperfections. So now the focus has drifted onto trying to capture the imperfections in the actual physical wind tunnel flow. In terms of modeling the region of interest, well, we decided to model the entire wind tunnel and see if we could get anything useful from it. And finally, everyone could put aside their egos and actually talk to each other. So, as I mentioned, we're doing these experiments in Cambridge, in the wind tunnel upstairs that you might have seen or done experiments in. A brief schematic, you can see the flow goes from the settling chamber through this converging diverging nozzle into the test section where we can do our measurements and then pass it out through the diffuser. Everything you'll see today is at Mach 2.5. and at the same time, the computations are performed by FRL. Importantly, as I mentioned earlier, we're computing the entire wind tunnel, all the way from the settling chamber through to the diffuser. And throughout this entire process, we're maintaining a close collaboration between the experiments and the computations. So, I'm first going to talk about how we've characterized the physical wind tunnel flow and the extra steps we've done because this is a validation study. I'm then going on to talk about two different stories that have come from this. Firstly, the discovery of some vortices within our flow, and secondly, looking at some sidewall flows, some secondary flows that developed that we discovered as a result of this. So firstly, what extra steps have we taken? Well, this is our schematic for wind tunnel flow, and in order to characterize it, we take various measurements that enable CFD simulations to actually capture the flow in the tunnel. We do things like measuring the inflow pressure distribution to see how uniform it is. We've measured, taken a Schlieren photograph of the flow that is able to capture any waves or imperfections. The CFD model is based on a CAD geometry of the tunnel, but we want to know whether the actual wind tunnel as it's installed in practice actually corresponds to this CAD geometry, so we've measured that in situ. We've looked at how strong any waves are within our wind tunnel by using sidewall pressure taps, and the answer was not very strong, but at least it's given us a quantification of how strong these waves are. And when people try to characterize a wind tunnel for CFD simulation, what they often do is just take a centerline boundary layer traverse there and use that as a measure of the boundary layer within the wind tunnel. Instead, we decided to measure as much of that cross-section as possible in order to get more velocity measures that could be used to calibrate the CFD model. And whilst doing all of this, we've tried to critically test assumptions that we normally make about the when we're doing experiments. For example, the accuracy of measurement techniques, or the fact that if any experiments we do are repeatable, or the fact that symmetries in the design geometry correspond to symmetries in the flow. Now, all three of these assumptions are actually okay or pretty good if we're just doing an experimental study, or even what I called earlier a phenomenological study. We're often looking for kind of differences between different configurations or different cases, and we're not actually that interested in whether the actual numerical values are correct as long as those differences are captured. However, when we're trying to compare the values quantitatively with computations, we need to actually look at these a bit more carefully. So in terms of the accuracy of measurements, we do a lot of our velocity measurements using a laser technique, but then we could take the same measurements using an old-fashioned pitot probe and compare the results. We can test the accuracy of our traverse system by taking the same measurements with a traverse going downwards, upwards, see how well they match, see the velocity at the same point by doing a vertical traverse and a horizontal traverse that intersect, and through that we could get an idea of how good this our measurement accuracy is. In terms of the repeatability, we in fact took apart the entire setup, put it back together, again, several months apart, and took exactly the same measurement. And that gave us an idea of what our repeatability was, and again, it was pretty good. In terms of the symmetries in the design geometry corresponding to symmetries in the flow, we didn't just assume that, given our wind tunnel was left-right symmetric, the flow would be left-right symmetric. We actually measured, as you saw in the picture before, all the way across the cross-section in order to try and work out how good this was. And this, I think, gives some sort of an idea of the extra step, the extra effort that we took in order to actually take careful measurements that we're able to calibrate the computations. And I think it's as a result of those extra efforts that these stories that I'll tell you actually came about. So, firstly, these vortices I was talking about. So, I showed you earlier that we took a Schlieren picture of the wind tunnel flow. You can see here there's a boundary layer on the floor, a boundary layer on the ceiling, and some weak mark waves, which are isentropic. They don't really change the flow. So that looks like a pretty clean flow. Now, when we took the same picture with a slightly more sensitive, higher speed camera, we saw that firstly, you can now see turbulent eddies within the flow. But there also seem to be these two structures, which are kind of streamwise structures going through the flow. And we were a bit confused about where these might come from, what they were. But luckily, we had a CFD simulation to help us. So when we asked the guys at AFRL to look at this CFD simulation, what they said was at the location where you see these, this is, by the way, a quarter of the wind tunnel simulated, So at the location where you see this, we see a vortex running along the tunnel sidewalk. So we then tried to see where this vortex comes from, traced upstream, and saw that it in fact comes from this region of separation upstream of the nozzle, where the flow seems to separate. So we hadn't really realized there was separation there, but maybe it's not so surprising. If we think about it, the flow that's coming in, it does have a favorable pressure gradient on that boundary layer, but at the same time, it sees this huge forward-facing step as it entered the nozzle. And so we shouldn't really be that surprised that it separates. What is slightly more surprising, however, is that the separation actually has an effect which can be captured all the way back here in the test section in the form of these vortices. So we wanted to see whether this separation was actually physical, so we did an experiment. We did all flow visualization on this region here, and indeed, we saw that there was a separation bubble in that region. Now, in order to try and look at this a bit further, we decided to try and target the separation. And as it seems to come from the fact that there's this sharp step, we did this by filleting the geometry or smoothing out that sharp step in order to see what would happen. So first, from the CFD, you can see here there's the sharp corner. We decided to fillet it by a radius of 5 local boundary layer thicknesses. And you can see there's not much difference between the two. We still have this separation. We still have this sidewall vortex. However, when we decided to take things a bit further and fillet it with a radius much larger, 25 boundary layer thicknesses, in fact, now the flow here is attached, and this vortex along the sidewall has disappeared. Of course, we weren't going to trust the CFD completely, so we decided to also look at the experiments on this. So firstly, you can see here, the top actually is exactly the same as what we had before, but on the floor, we've now introduced this slight fillet. And when we took the oil flow visualization upstream of the nozzle in this region, we saw that there was still the separation predicted from the CFD, and indeed, there were still the vortices in the Schlieren image of the flow. But when we took the same measurements with this larger radius fillet, so you can still see the sharp corner at the top, but a filleted geometry on the floor. We did the oil flow and see nice attached flow all the way throughout the nozzle. And when we look at the Schlieren image, we can see this top vortex still exists because the top corner is still sharp, but the bottom vortex has disappeared. So this has showed us that these structures that we see are indeed vortices, and they do come from that separation that we saw upstream of the nozzle. We then wanted to know how much of an impact these vortices actually have on the flow. So we looked at the CFD solution, and we can see here where there's this bulge in the sidewall boundary layer actually corresponds to the location of the vortex. Again, when we haven't got rid of the vortex, this bulge still exists. In the third case, now we've got a nice smooth boundary layer, the bulge has disappeared. So this has given us an idea that these vortices can actually have quite a big impact on the shape of that sidewall boundary layer. And there was no reason why these vortices just exist in Cambridge. So we looked and actually saw a variety of different facilities, Schlieren images from over many years, which may show a similar vortex structure. These all have sharp geometry changes upstream of the nozzle, so could create similar vortices. And now as cameras are becoming more sensitive and techniques are improving, we'd expect Schlieren images to be more likely to capture these vortices, and so knowing what they are helps us to interpret these kinds of images. Okay, so I'm now going to tell the second story about these secondary flows. And the story really starts because we need to take velocity measurements in the corner regions for a validation study. So the way that we obtain these measurements is by using a laser technique called laser Doppler velocimetry, or LDV. And this requires tracer particles. We put particles into the flow that move along with the flow, and then we can use a laser technique in order to work out the velocity of these particles. So we actually want to measure the velocity in the working section here, but we can't introduce the seeding particles in this region because they would disturb the flow. So instead, we introduce the particles all the way up here in the settling chamber. So this is the settling chamber. The flow is going into the page, and we introduce the flow in the past through a vertical rake that passes through the middle of the settling. There are holes on the far side of this vertical rake, and it ejects the seeding particles into the flow, into the page. So we're interested in the flow in the working section. So this is basically the span of the working section in the bottom 15 millimeters close to the floor. Now, when we looked at the seeding particle distribution, we saw there are lots of particles in the middle, because we've introduced the particles here. So that means we can get good measurements in this region. But when we get close to the corners, which is where we want to take our validation quality measurements, we in fact have very few particles, and so we can't get good quality measurements. So the obvious solution is to introduce a corner rake, put a new rake into this wind tunnel that enables us to seed those regions. But this is a 60-year-old contraction. We don't really want to start drilling holes in it arbitrarily. So we decided to take help from CFD to determine where to put these rakes. So what we did is we looked in the working section and took streamlines from the corner regions where we wanted the seeding to reach and traced them upstream all the way into the settling chamber. And just a different perspective now shows where these streamlines originated, so we knew where to place our corner rake. So now in theory, seeding in these corners should be possible. So this picture I showed you earlier with the vertical rake and the particles will go through the center. Now when we replaced it with a corner rake, as we'd intended, these seeding particles were now in the corner regions. And this corner seeding is actually very useful. Firstly, it lets us take validation quality measurements in these corners, the regions of interest, but also it enables us to probe the wider flow field. I mentioned earlier that we wanted to take measurements across as much of the cross-section as possible, and we've basically managed to measure the boundary layer all the way around the wind tunnel, and that wouldn't have been possible unless we were able to inject flow into the corners here. So, when we measured these boundary layers, you can see the floor and ceiling boundary layers are pretty uniform across much of the span of the tunnel, and they're about the same thickness as each other. But now when we look at these sidewall boundary layers, you can see they're very thin at the corners and get thicker towards the centre. So, in order to better understand why this might happen, we decided to consider the expansion wave pattern through the nozzle. So here you've got a kind of discrete method of characteristics inviscid solution, which shows the expansion wave pattern as the flow goes from high pressure to low pressure as it accelerates through the nozzle. So if we consider a plane, say, halfway between the nozzle throat and the exit, and think about the pressure in that cross-section, we're going to have a relatively low pressure, it's dark blue here, and high pressure near the floor and the ceiling. So the flow in the sidewall boundary layers is going to have the least momentum, it's going to be the most susceptible to this vertical pressure gradient. And so as a result, we're going to induce some sort of a secondary flow of vertical velocity due to this pressure gradient within the cycle boundary layers. And in fact, if we measure the vertical velocity further downstream, where red is up and blue is down, we indeed see we've got blue regions here in the cycle boundary layers and red regions here, which are in the directions predicted from this. The white regions are areas where I couldn't get enough seeding particles to take high quality measurements. And indeed now, when we look at the streamwise velocity distribution, it now makes sense. The low momentum flow in those sidewall boundary layers has been moved by those sidewall secondary flows. And in fact, these secondary flows are just generated by pressure gradients. We'd expect the CFD to capture these accurately. And you might be able to see the thin boundary layer here getting thicker towards the center height from the picture that I showed you. So, in order to test this a bit further, we decided to consider another nozzle geometry that's typically used in supersonic wind tunnels. So, we've already seen this converging-diverging nozzle, but another typical nozzle geometry basically involves blocking off the bottom half of the wind tunnel. And if you compare the expansion wave patterns, they're identical, we've just got the top up. So these two types of nozzle geometry are generally widely used and considered to be identical to each other. Now, if we consider the same expansion wave pattern through the two, in this case, instead of having high pressure, low pressure, high pressure, we've just got high pressure at the top and low pressure at the bottom. So we should expect these secondary flows to just move from the top corners to the bottom corners. And indeed, those are what we see with the vertical velocities. And the sidewall boundary layer shape now looks very different. It's thin at the top and thick at the bottom corners. So just a slightly bigger picture of that. We can see these two nozzle geometries, which are generally considered to be equivalent to each other, indeed have the same core velocity. The floor and ceiling boundary layers are about as thick as each other and pretty uniform across the tunnel span. But the sidewall boundary layers have very different shapes in the two. In the full nozzle, it gets thick at the center and thin in the corners, whereas in the half nozzle, it's thin in the top and thick at the bottom. Now, there's also differences in the corner regions, which I'll come on to, but firstly, a brief aside as to why these corner regions matter. So I mentioned at the start with these different figures on different applications that corner regions have a big impact on the flow when it separates. And the reason for that is that this shock-induced corner separation, in fact, affects the entire flow field. And in turn, we expect this corner separation to be affected by the flow, by the momentum within the corner boundary layers itself. And we can kind of see that because the corner boundary layers really correspond to the intersection between the floor boundary layer and the side of the boundary layer. So we can imagine they might meet something like this. And because of the viscosity in these boundary layers, the region in the corners has very low momentum. And this, in the presence of a shock, will tend to make it separate very early. On the other hand, this isn't the entire picture. So if I was to plot streamwise velocity, we see the boundary layer edge doesn't follow that contour that I showed. In fact, it seems to be following something like this. And that's because, due to the Reynolds stress and anisotropies in the corner region, the counter-rotating pair of vortices is generated, and these serve to draw high momentum flow in from the core flow into the corners, and so tend to increase the momentum within these corner regions. So we've got these two different factors that kind of compete against each other, and in fact, in practice, we see that separation tends to occur earliest in corners, which suggests that this is the factor that's winning. So anyway, back to our corners. We see that these four corners for the full nozzle setup look pretty much the same, which we might expect, the flows top, bottom, and left, right symmetric in terms of the geometry. But the half nozzle looks quite different. So these top corners actually look very much like those from the full nozzle, but the bottom corners, not so much. So one reason which we've already talked about is the sidewall boundary layers. In the full nozzle, they get thick in the middle and then get thinner towards the corners, whereas here they're thin at the top and get thicker towards the bottom. But there also seems to be a difference in the structure, the shape of the boundary layer itself. So as we just discussed, this structure is probably determined by vortices which exist here. So we can draw on regions of momentum transfer between the core and the boundary layers themselves. And from that, we can infer some sort of a vortex configuration or vortex topology within these different corners. As you can see, these corners contain only one vortex, whereas these seem to contain a vortex pair. And we can explain these through the mechanism of these sidewall secondary flows as well. So if there'd been no sidewall secondary flow, no vertical velocities in the sidewall boundary layers, then the Reynolds stress and anisotropies would generate a counter-rotating vortex pair that's symmetric at the corner bisector. However, that never happens in reality in these cases here. In these red cases, we've got the sidewall secondary flow, which is directed away from the corner. And so what that means is that any vorticity inside the sidewall boundary layer is affected away by this secondary vorticity, by the secondary flow. And so we're left with a single vortex on the floor in this case, as we can see in the experiment. On the other hand, when the vertical velocity is directed towards the corner, as in the bottom corners of the half nozzle, we see that we retain a corner vortex pair that's no longer symmetric about the corner bisector, as I've marked on in the experimental momentum transfers. So we've talked about how the nozzle geometry through these sidewall secondary flows can impact the corner boundary layers. But now we want to fill in them, and the vortices are interesting, but they're not the main point. The main point is that simply by changing the nozzle geometry, we can generate two very different corner boundary layers for the same Mach number flow and the same floor boundary layer. Here, with the contoured nozzle on the floor, we get very thin corner boundary layers, whereas when we flip it upside down, in the half nozzle case that I mentioned earlier, we've got thick corner boundary layers on the floor. And now, what we can then do is see how these play a role when the flow is introduced to a shock in terms of the corner separation and the resultant impact on the overall flow field. So we do this by putting a wedge into the flow, which generates an oblique shock, and that reflects off the floor, and we can study the interaction on the tunnel floor. So the first thing we do is take a Schlieren image of the flow, try and work out what the wave pattern is. And on a first glance, these look pretty similar to each other. In fact, it's a typical wave pattern for a separated oblique shockwave boundary layer interaction. We can see this incident shock here, which is generated by the wedge. And due to the adverse pressure gradient, this causes the boundary layer to separate. Now, the flow deflection due to the separation results in a separation shock. Then as there's streamline curvature over the separation bubble itself, there's an expansion fan, and then as the flow reattaches, there's a much weaker reattachment shock. And these two pictures both look more or less the same, suggesting that we've got to separate it completely from banking and contract in both cases. But to probe it a bit further, we in fact do all flow visualization on the tunnel floor to see what the footprint of this flow topology looks like. So the dotted lines you can see here are the envisaged shock reflection positions. And when we perform the all flow visualization, we can see various skin friction lines. And to make things easier, I've marked on the regions of separation across them. So again, at first glance, it's vaguely the same topology. We've got a center line central separation, a corner separation which starts further upstream in both cases, and channels with an attached flow between them. In order to compare the two, we can place these topologies on top of each other, and now we start to see some differences. For example, the red case with the thinner corner boundary layers, the separation starts further downstream than the blue case. The separation, at least the footprint on the floor, seems to be a lot thinner than for the blue case, and it does indeed seem to reattach, or at least the separation moves off the floor at some point downstream. Now, this impact, or this difference in corner separation, actually also has an impact on the central separation. We can see here that the red separation with these thin corner boundary layers and this more benign corner separation is actually more two-dimensional. It extends across more of the span of the tunnel and in fact covers a smaller stream-wise extent. So it's interesting to see that these two flows with the same mark number flow, the same boundary layer, in fact have very different separation topologies from the floor. And this is captured more when we consider boundary layer traverses upstream and downstream of the interaction. So first, upstream of the interaction, we see that the floor boundary layers on the center line, at this point, coming into both interactions, are about as thick as each other, about as full as each other. They have the same core mark number, and the oblique shock angle in both cases is the same. But despite this, when we look downstream, the red case, which has the smallest streamwise separation due to the thinner corner boundary layers, in fact ends up with a much more full boundary layer profile. So, I've now talked about how the nozzle geometry can in fact influence the corner boundary layers, and then when there's a shock, influence the corner separation, and this seems to influence the entire flow field. And this has some important consequences. So firstly, any supersonic wind tunnel with a rectangular cross-section is typically generated with one of these two types of nozzles that we've seen. And so these sidewall secondary flows will exist in pretty much every supersonic wind tunnel with a rectangular cross-section. And this means that the nozzle geometry will in some way or other affect any experiment on corner flows or separation in the tunnel floor. So when we're comparing experiments, especially between different facilities or different types of experiment, it's worth bearing the nozzle geometry in mind. And now, as we're comparing experiments with computational simulations more and more, we've now seen that the nozzle geometry will determine the kind of quantitative characteristics of the flow itself. And so if the CFD simulation doesn't simulate this nozzle geometry, or at least have some kind of knowledge of the nozzle geometry, there's no way that it can accurately capture either the corner flows or experiments on the separation of the tunnel floor. And finally, in aircraft inlets, we expect to see similar oblique waves, which are likely to generate similar vertical pressure gradients. So we might expect a similar mechanism to play a part in these types of applications as well. So just to take a step back quickly, we wouldn't have found any of this out unless, firstly, we were trying to measure the entire flow field, so measure the boundary layers all the way around, in order to calibrate simulations of the computations. And also, we wouldn't have been able to find out unless we were actually able to put seeding into the corners through this CFD-aided design of the corner seeding system. So, to conclude, I'm just going to show these views that I showed at the beginning, and whether you consider the fact that we discovered these sidewall vortices, whether you consider the fact that we've got these sidewall secondary flows, or the effect on separation in such experiments, I think we've shown that CFD is now good enough to capture the imperfection from the tunnel. We could see that when we actually saw what these vortices were in the RAND simulations. We've seen that modeling the entire tunnel is probably not only useful, it's actually essential in some cases. And I think throughout I've shown that the close collaboration between CFD and experiments can actually offer us a lot more insight than just experimental CFD alone. Thank you very much.
sidewall, if the band layers are thicker in the middle of the sidewall,
yeah.
Why don't you see, do you not see any shock-induced separation there?
So, yeah. Often, well, if you think about an oblique shock reflection,
yeah.
Your pressure gradient, or your pressure rise across, on the floor you've effectively got double the pressure rise. So, our experiments at least are set up, say, the half that pressurized wouldn't cause separation. So, because you've got a much smaller pressurize on the glancing shock interaction than on the oblique shock reflection, even with a thick band layer, probably wouldn't cause.
I'm surprised that you don't have any number in your presentation, like what is the Mach number?
I think I've said at some point the Mach number is 2.5.
2.5.
But apart from that, I think pictures tell 1,000 numbers.
Well, maybe four people know that. And it's not.
Is there an opportunity to use data simulation? Because you have so much data, is there an opportunity to use data simulation to make your simulations even more quantitative accurate? I mean, surely there is a perfect agreement between your data and
So, no, there's not. And I think one of the ways in which we can kind of optimize or try and calibrate the actual CFD model to best represent the data is something which, I don't know, something which hasn't really been done a lot, especially given we've got lots of different types of data. So it's something which we haven't looked into, but would probably be good to do.
So what is this two stripes really affect in reality?
Okay, so in a lot of wind tunnel experiments, even the ones like this, it probably makes very little difference to the actual experiment itself, and especially given that a lot of experiments are done on the center line by putting an object in there. But if you're trying to interpret a Schlieren image, and you saw these two lines, and you had something upstream, which you couldn't see, you might think that these two lines come from something in the flow induced by the object you're testing. Whereas now, if you know that these come from vortices on the sidewalls, you're able to interpret the Schlieren image in a way that makes sense, or you won't come to any wrong conclusions by thinking they're something other than what they are. And also, we now know how to get rid of them. So if people are designing a new wind tunnel, they can design a wind tunnel so that these vortices never exist in the first place.
Would these two strips really give you completely wrong interpretation? I don't know.
I mean, it depends what your interpretation is after seeing them.
Let's say, like, you would actually look at the interaction of the shock onto a sidewall boundary layer, and you have these two vortices coming along the sidewall. Do we know if that at all influences the structure of a separate, if you'd have separation on the sidewall?
So are you putting a shock across like that?
Yeah, so if you'd have a shock, we'd go onto those vortex structures.
One thing we haven't actually done, which might be useful to do, is to actually characterize how strong these vortices are. But we know that sufficiently strong vortices, as you get from vortex generators, they can be effective at, if not eliminating, at least changing the structure of the sidewall separation, and so I guess it would be no different.
We actually have some flow visualization of a normal shock and the separation in the sidewall. And it's always bothered me that the separation on the sidewall is not very two-dimensional. It had these wobbles in it. And I just said, well, that's because our tunnel isn't all that good. So if you look at Cash's thesis, you will find those.
Okay.
And I think now we know where those wobbles came from. We just never knew.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm there. Thank you very much for sitting.